Chapter 27. The radio call had arrived faintly and in a single transmission. Repeated efforts by the Narwhal's radio operator to verify the message was met with complete silence. Captain Stenzith read the hand-scribbled message transcribed by his radio man, shook his head, and then read the message once more.
Mayday, mayday. This is Ice Lab 7. The camp is breaking up, he recited aloud.
That's all you got? He asked, his eyes glaring. The radio man nodded silently. Stenzith turned and stepped to the helmsman. All ahead flank speed, he barked. Come left, steer course 015. He turned to the executive officer. I want to plot the Ice Lab's reported position and call three additional lookouts to the bridge. In an instant, he was towering over the radio operator's shoulder. Notify the regional U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards of the distress call and tell them that we are responding. Alert any local traffic if there is any. Then get Gunn and Giordino to the bridge.
Sir, the nearest Coast Guard station is Canadian, at Tuktoyaktuk. That's over 200 miles away.
Stenzith gazed at the blowing wind buffeting the bridge's windscreens, his mind conjuring an image of the ice camp inhabitants. Softening his tone, he replied quietly, Then I guess that means their only saving angel is wearing turquoise wings. The Narwhal was rated at 23 knots, but even running flat out, the research ship could barely muster a dozen knots lunging through the storm-whipped seas. The storm had reached its peak, with winds gusting over 70 miles per hour. The sea was a boiling cauldron of 30-foot waves that pitched and rolled the ship like it was made of cork. The helmsman nervously monitored the ship's autopilot, waiting for the mechanism to go tilt from the constant course corrections necessary to keep the vessel on a fixed northeast heading. Gunn and Giordino soon joined Stenzith on the bridge, studying the ice camp's mayday message.
It is a little early in the season for the ice to be breaking up in a cataclysmic fashion, Gunn said, rubbing his chin. Though the moving ice sheet can certainly fracture on short notice. Typically, you would have a little bit of a warning.
Perhaps they were surprised by a small fracture that struck a portion of the camp, such as their radio facility or even their power generators, Stenzith suggested.
Let's hope it's nothing worse than that, Gunn agreed,
gazing at the maelstrom outside. As long as they have some degree of shelter from the storm, they should be all right for a while.
There is another possibility, Giordino added quietly. The ice camp may have been situated too close to the sea. The storm surge could have broken up the leading edge of the ice field, taking the camp apart in the process.
The other two men nodded grimly, knowing that the odds of survival were severely diminished if that was the case.
What's the outlook on the storm? Gunn asked.
Another 6 to 8 hours before it abates.
We'll have to wait it out before we can drop a search team on the ice, I'm afraid, Stenzith replied.
Sir, the helmsman interrupted, we're seeing large ice in the water.
Stenzith looked up to see a house-sized iceberg slip past the port bow.
All engines back a third. What's our distance to the ice camp?
Just under 18 miles, sir.
Stenzith stepped over to a large radar screen and adjusted the range to a 20-mile diameter. A thin, jagged green line crossed the screen near the top edge, which remained fixed in place. The captain pointed to a spot just below the line, where a concentric ring on the scope indicated a distance of 20 miles.
Here's the reported position of the camp, he said somberly.
If it was an oceanfront property before, it is now, Giordino observed.
Gunn squinted at the radar scope, then pointed a finger at a fuzzy dot at the edge of the screen.
There's a ship nearby, he said.
Stenzith took a look, noting that the ship was headed to the southeast. He ordered the radio operator to hail the ship, but they failed to receive a response.
Maybe an illegal whaler, the captain suggested.
The Japanese occasionally slip into the Beaufort to hunt beluga whales.
In these seas, they're probably too busy hanging onto their shorts to pick up the radio, Giordino said.
The unknown vessel was quickly forgotten as they closed in on the ice shelf and the reported position of the ice camp. As the narwhal crept closer to the site, larger and larger slabs of broken ice began clogging up the sea in front of them. By now, the entire ship's complement had been alerted of the rescue mission. More than a dozen research scientists braved the harsh weather and joined the crew on deck. Dressed in full foul weather gear, they lined the rails of the ominously rolling ship, scanning the seas for their fellow Arctic scientists. The narwhal arrived at the ice camp's reported position, and Stenseth brought the narwhal to within 100 feet of the ice sheet. The research ship cruised slowly along the jagged border, dodging around numerous icebergs that had recently severed from the ice field. The captain ordered every light on board illuminated and repeatedly let loose a blast from the ship's deafening Kallenberg air horns as a possible rescue beacon. The powering winds began to abate slightly, allowing brief glimpses through the swirling snow. All eyes scanned the thick shelf of the sea ice, as well as the frozen waters, for signs of the ice camp or its inhabitants. Drifting over the camp's reported position, not a sign was detected. If anything or anybody was left at the scene, they were now residing 2,000 feet beneath the dark gray waters.